assistance in submitting online. Go paperless and think green. The Community Calendar is a public service of KVMR. Thank you for listening to KVMR, and stay tuned now for Michael Stone and Conversations.
My guest today is James O'Dea. He's a fellow and immediate past president of the Institute of Noetic Sciences and a former faculty member of the Omega Institute. He's also former director of Save a Foundation and a former director of the Washington, D.C. Office of Amnesty International. James is a member of the World Wisdom Council and currently collaborating with the Global Systems Initiatives in Washington, D.C., an evolutionary leaders group spearheaded by Deepak Chopra. His latest book, which we'll be talking about today, is Creative Stress, A Path for Evolving Souls Living Through Personal and Planetary Upheaval. Welcome to Conversations, James.
Great to be here with you.
Well, it's great to have you. You've been on the forefront of the study of evolving consciousness for many, many years. And I'd like to have you just give us a sense of how you see the state of the world right now, and particularly in relationship to the evolution of consciousness.
Well, that's just a tiny question to address, but we must address it.
Yes, we must.
We must look at it. And I think where I'd like to begin is, you know, what Jacob Needleman once said about the Western consciousness as predominantly pointed. It's sort of a mental framing pointedness. Tolstoy once said that it should be impossible to live other than through one's conscience rather than through mentally envisioned notions of reality. So here we are at this moment where all of that mental pointedness is clearly breaking down, because we're whole beings and we're part of a whole system. We have hearts as well as, you know, as brains. We are embedded in a whole living system that is interfused with life at many, many levels of sensitive consciousness. And so what we see is that pointedness breaking down, and its systems that have created it breaking down. And evolution is in the business, is in the process of helping us here, because evolution experiments. It's not about right and wrong, good and evil, who are the good guys, who are the bad guys in consciousness. It can't be. It's sort of, well, that's where you took that learning strategy, and now evolution says, and by the way, that's a dead end. And so what evolution does is then recapitulates. It goes back through the learning of the species, and it says, what was the advantage in those small tribal groups? How did you thrive there? What security did you have? And yet you had to expand beyond that. And as you expanded, you had to create laws and regulations to govern a larger sense of the whole. And now we're peeking our heads through, breaking through towards this global consciousness, this, you know, completely inclusive state where we say our species has to connect with the whole of life process in order for this enterprise to work. And so we go back through that learning of the species, through the various stages, recapitulated, and then rediscover. It's a sort of almost the once and future syndrome becomes operative here, that you go back and you say, yes, this was the advantage of the past, and this is the advantage of the globalization, because now we can serve the whole. So we're at that moment where the cracking of the brittleness of the old consciousness is really very evident, and the question becomes, what then pops us through to the next level?
And it's a good question. One of the things that's simplistic but inherent in what you are saying, from what I hear, is that in a way consciousness is programmed to thrive in its going back and looking, that seems to be essentially part of the operating system of evolution itself, that thriving is inherent in evolution. Am I missing that, or is that what you're saying in the background of the working and going backwards?
I think that's very well put, yes, that there is this optimization that has to, yeah, that is being sought, which then takes us right into the heart of belief, doesn't it? Because we now know that, you know, belief is very deep. It's not just something that's held in the mind, it's actually held in the body. I mean, Bruce Lipton's work, The Biology of Belief, how belief affects our genetic switches and triggers. So, you know, we look at belief and we say, well, what do we believe about this question of thriving? Do we believe that somehow there is a deity that created this psychotic game of suffering that then, and then said to us, and by the way, there are some escape routes, you can get out and come back to me? I mean, what a perverse notion that is, that somehow the whole structure of our belief, you know, has centered, you know, around escaping the suffering of this planet, rather than the potential of the belief that it's here in the manifest realm of this planet that we can thrive, we can optimize, we can experience beauty and truth and justice and manifest them in this adventure of becoming. That's a rather different scenario, isn't it?
That is very different. And paradoxically, though, isn't it that our unexamined beliefs and assumptions that we live inside of are, in fact, shaping the very reality to which we're being confronted? This is, I think, something you go into in your book in different ways. Without meeting those beliefs head on in a way that we can examine their ultimate truth, that we are in big trouble without going to that, as a really almost a beginning step, it seems.
Right. We're back to reframing the fundamental grammar of our consciousness. And, you know, Ken Wilber has those four quadrants: I, it, we, and systems, as the fundamental grammar that we must now say, yes, the unexamined beliefs around it and I, you know, are getting shaken at the roots, because the it is no longer out there as something to be trampled on as a dead thingness of the world, but rather the I and the it are starting to interpenetrate in a way in consciousness, you know, from quantum physics to the neurosciences. That sensitive connectivity between what I am and what the world is around me is no longer I living, conscious, you dead, it out there. And so, though the substructure, as you're saying, of those beliefs that have been unexamined, unexplored, now is at this beautiful, tender point where we look at who am I, what is an I, what is a we.
What is a they, too? That's one of the essential ones.
Well, notice in those quadrants, there is no Dre.
I know.
I am you, and you are me in some form. And who are they? Well, they are history. They are the part of us that we couldn't understand or dialogue with or appreciate as an us. And global consciousness has to surrender the they, the otherizing, just as it surrenders the it and the deadness and the domination of nature. It then transforms the relationship with it and the inclusivity of us. Absolutely.
It will, in any of the atrocities, and there have been some pretty amazing atrocities in the last 100 years, I guess always, but at the heart of them, to me, it always seems that inherent is this they, this otherness, not a sacred otherness, but the otherness. How could I do what I do to another human being in these realm of atrocities without this embedded sense of separation that lives inside of they?
Absolutely. And, you know, my own journey has been very much to look at what that woundedness is that gets transferred intergenerationally. It's almost as if we treasure the wound and hold on to it and say, remember what they did to us and who they are, and you must never trust them. And so my own work in this emerging field of social healing is very much to explore the nature of that us and them. I mean, there are no lesser beings on the face of this earth. We do understand that, right? There are no lesser beings on the face of this earth. And so once we get transcend that particular obstacle, then we have work to do, because the wound, as Desmond Tutu says, it's not a trivial matter. It's not as if a little New Age aphorism is going to dispel the wound. I mean, I love aphorisms and I love affirmations, but there is something, some deeper work. So Desmond Tutu says, you know, you have to open the wound. You have to wash the wound clean, and then you can apply the balm. And I think there's a sort of, in some New Age circles, there's this, you know, bring in the balm of, you know, it's all beautiful. And, well, no, we have to reopen that sense of what damaged us. Understand, as you were saying, that deeper structure and the root causes. Then we can wash it and heal the division. And I've been very interested and I'm still engaged in dialogue. And the greatest moment of dialogue for me was between a Nazi, a former Nazi, and a Holocaust survivor. And ultimately, in their dialogue, she says to Mary Rothschild, says to Gottfried Leif, "Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, yet I shall fear no ill, for thou art with me." That's evolution working. Here she says to the former Nazi that she is now reconciled with, it's the game is over, history is completed, because I say, you know, that you are now at my side. There's no need to fear. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, there I shall fear no ill, because you are there. That's because, consciousness evolving.
Absolutely. And because the most important thing to me in listening to what you're saying is the I say. The I say. Because the understanding takes us to the doorstep. Whether we're going to ring the bell or walk in is a whole nother area. And so many people have gotten to the doorstep and not pushed the bell. You know, I'm thinking of Truth and Reconciliation, for instance, and the amazing work that people did in that. And I'm thinking of your book, Creative Stress, that we want to talk about a little bit, and how much, when you're at the doorstep, in a sense, it is a stressful situation. And I'd like to move a little bit into talking about how you see stress. What is it? You know, really, I mean, operationally, what is it? And begin to look at how stress has to do with free choice and the willingness to move into our own dark night, into our own unexamined beliefs, those types of things. Can you give us an operational definition of stress, and then let's begin to take that apart and look and see how we can move into that in a way that helps evolution itself in consciousness?
Mm-hmm. Well, this year I've been invited to speak at the National Qigong Association as a keynote speaker, and at first I thought, well, ooh, why are they asking me? I'm not a Qigong guy. And they said, well, because you understand this nature of the universal energy as it enters into our experience. So that's what I say about stress is, you know, what you have, first of all, is the undifferentiated energy of the universe coming to you. You have the basic map is energy and consciousness. And when the energy moves, if it moves through the consciousness, you have the pure witnessing capacity of the consciousness to say, this is the nature and quality of those particular energies. When the consciousness deflects, gets sticky, says, give me more of that, but less of that. Turn that away. That's where you have the dial in relationship to stress. Because you're basically saying to the primary universe or energy of the universe, I don't want you, I can't handle you, I'm not going to take you. And it is basically your humble and obedient servant. It is there for your consciousness to clarify its nature. So it's going to hang around. So what we call negative stress is the energy of the universe that has a message for you, which you haven't bothered to open, or which you said, hold off, wait. And it waits, believe you me, until your body, you know, will finally succumb to the message. So the structure of the book, I begin with what I call the direct encounter, that you cannot move forward unless you have a direct encounter with this universal energy that's come to teach you something. And I say, basically, the path does not get easier. Who's telling you this stuff? Well, I hear those voices out there. Some of them are very influential. The path does not, in my experience, get easier. It gets deeper. It gets richer. Because that energy, as you cooperate with it, as you turn to it and say, wow, you really have a message for me. You're really trying to teach me something. You're really trying to move through my consciousness to ascend to that higher levels of my own capacity to grow and to experience and to witness the nature of reality. What a gift!
Yeah, what a gift. So let's get into the particulars then about how we can use stress to, as an opening, raise awareness as an opportunity to assist in this awakening of consciousness.
I think nothing creative happens in the world without stress, does it? I mean, the neuroscientist Jer Levy says perhaps one of the most defining aspects of the human development is its capacity to rise and meet challenge. So it's essentially that cooperation with the energy that says, I'm going to have to stretch you. You're going to have to grow if you're to fully potentiate and arrive at your deepest capacities. And growing involves stretching. And so that first stage of what is the nature of stress as your teacher, of this energy, as your teacher, is to not only have the direct encounter with it, but begin to cooperate with it. So the second part of the book I call the handshake with stress. It's that crucial moment when you have not only started to live in integrity with that energy, not hold it back, not deflect it, but you really are bowing to it as your teacher. And it's the equivalent of, hello darkness, my old friend, you've come to visit me again. You know, it's that sense of, wow, it's a map of wholeness. It's a map of deep wholeness and healing. You know, the word healing derives from the concept of wholeness.
Let's distinguish for our listeners between the negative stress and creative stress, and perhaps you could give some real examples of yourself or others in the movement from one through into the other.
Yes, there are many stories in the book that come from my experience, and my own experience took me, you know, before I actually became director of the Washington Office of Amnesty. I was in Turkey during the Civil War. I was knifed. My house was machine gunned. I went from there to Beirut. I was in Beirut during the Israeli invasion, during the massacre of the Palestinians. And if I may tell you a story, because I do think that the story can help us. During that period when the Israelis invaded West Beirut, all of the electricity was cut off. There were flares being shot up at night, and we didn't know, in the southern part of the city, we didn't know what that was. And what emerged was that the Israeli army had encircled the Palestinian camps, and they had allowed in their right-wing militias, and hence the murder of women and children, children under their beds, children and women lying, you know, murdered in the streets. And, you know, I was part of work with the Middle East Council of Churches that was helping an international medical team, and they got caught up in this. So I found out very early from the medical team what had transpired. And the lights went off. The lights went off in my own imagination, in my kind of like a spiritual nadir, that this degree of trauma and stress that I saw in the world, I hit a really low point, that this is humanity, this is part of my species, and this is how foul they get. It was a graphic sense of desperation in the human enterprise. And a few days later, I went south to another Palestinian camp called Ain el-Helwe. And that had been, you know, when we say camps, you know, these are buildings that bricks and mortar, because from 1948 is a long time to stay in a tent. So you know, they built these, you know, bricks and mortar camps. And the camp had been flattened in the bombing. It was just rubble. It was like a mile square of rubble. And in the middle of the rubble, there was an old man, and I was with some doctors, and he was beckoning, calling. And we went over, and he wanted to pour us coffee. And we said, no, it's like looking into the rubble. What are you doing? And this had been, part of it had been the roof of his house, and he pulled out a calor gas stove. He insisted on making us coffee, and he, you know, the flick of the wrist as the coffee starts to boil up, and then they let it simmer down, and cracked cups and whatever. We sat in the rubble and drank this. And it was at that moment that I perceived something very, very profound, because I saw in this person the fact that no bomb will ever destroy this, that the human spirit is indomitable. It was a very profound insight into that energy in creation, saying, no matter what you have done to wound, to hurt, to destroy, in all of your unskillfulness, in all of your warring, and there was no animosity in his being. It was not like he was ranting speeches of hate. What he wanted us to see was that dignity, was that essence. So that's a paradigm for me in understanding that, you know, even on this grand scale, when we talk about stress, you know, I can tell you deeply the stories of people who've been tortured, who've been, you know, right on in the most profound levels of horror in the world, because that's where part of my life has taken me. And so it's from there that I can say that the story of negative stress is that story of our incompetence, of our difficult learning. It will not go away. That energy will not go away. It will wait for those luminous moments that say, do you see me? Do you know who I am in my deeper nature? And it's the cooperation with that story of conciliation, forgiveness, gratefulness, the resurrection, if you like, of the human spirit, that we can talk about creative stress. Because creative stress, nothing happens without this energy, right? It's not as if somehow we're waiting for Mother Goose or Twinkie to come along and make it all right. That we have to take this energy, and it will help us grow. But no great reform, no great leadership has come without enduring and transforming that energy. So it's primarily a story of taking the energy that's rejected. When we talked about the other, that's negative stress stored. When you otherize another person, you are simply holding off your learning until the day comes when you can say, my brother, my sister, forgive my incompetence. That, you know, because of the size of your nose, because of the color of your skin, because of the ethnic background you came from, that I made you a thing, an it, an other. And as soon as you have that, that creative, what I call the creative stress, the energy then says, let's grow, let's take it higher, let's commune together.
Yeah. One of the things you talk about in your book that I'd like to address in terms of stress is you talk about discovering our core being or our core passion. And when I look out at the world and I see people preoccupied with celebrity occurrences and these kinds of things, and I think, how can these people get a sense of their own natural genius, their own essence, their own core being or passion? How can stress lead us in that direction?
Right, there is this saying, God is a circle whose center is everywhere, whose circumference can never be found. So in the mystery of consciousness, we are always in the center. We are never at the periphery, even though hierarchies, structures, educational systems, and so on may try to say, you know, like, who are you in the pecking order? And, you know, how far are you away from the center of power and the center of money making and the center? And so that, you know, once you begin to experience this mysterious design in consciousness that the center is everywhere, that you are in fact a direct connection to the whole. You are a part of the whole and a direct connection to the whole. You begin to experience the qualities of the whole that want to express through you. And I love the thinking of this 13th century Sufi mystic called Muhyiddin Ibn al-Arabi. Many people know about Mevlana Jalaluddin Rumi. In Sufism, he's called the pole of love. Ibn al-Arabi is called the pole of knowledge. And Ibn al-Arabi says something that's not quite New Age, because he does say that you are an instance of the whole, that you're an instance of the divine. You can't be all of the parts, but you can reflect accurately your part in the whole. And he says, it's a very Platonic idea. Imagine the qualities of the whole are raining down like a shower, and you become one aspect of the blend of the whole. It's a unique dial-in that says, I represent these aspects of love and truth and justice and beauty, whatever your particular dimensions are. So it gives complete relevance to who you are in the story. It's like the greatest of mysteries. You know, I'm sure there are myths that we could pull up if we thought about. It's like the one who will remember who they are, and when they remember who they are, the story gets changed because they have slipped in to the configuration of the whole. And my God, does that sing to my bones when I think of all of those people who've massacred and murdered and who have been objectified because of what I would call unskillfulness in thinking that they were somehow inferior, the lower caste, the wrong crowd, not the in-group. And that our discovery has to be that for ourselves. So I hope it's a clear point that I'm making, that it has to be experienced, that nobody can give you that. One of my great spiritual teachers said to me once, you know, James, nothing of real value will ever be handed to you directly. It will be born out of you. It will emerge from you. So the skillful teacher is the one who helps you arrive at yourself. That's always the hallmark of an authentic teacher. In an age when we have a lot of babble, fantasy, and seduction, that's one of the keynotes to a good teacher. Do they elicit you, that you become more fully yourself. And in doing so, when you come into that fullness of yourself, you eat stress for breakfast. I mean, you you say, I want to become. I'm now in the adventure of becoming. There's a certain kind of aliveness. And it's a beautiful path because it is filled with challenges and growth opportunities. As soon as you think you've arrived at one place, it's like these great mountains, lie ahead. Like I say in the book, at one point you're doing so well, and then you get what in the I Ching is called mountain arresting progress. And that's a very good thing. It's a very good, if you
doesn't
read
doesn't seem like it at the time.
It doesn't. But what it, you know, mountain arresting progress says, you know, wow, you have made progress. Now you need to organize because there's the next part of the climb ahead.
You know, you talk about story. I've done quite a few shows, you know, with the people who have been heavily influenced by Thomas Berry and others. And one time Brian Swim and I were talking, and I was trying to understand how he said we're all at the center of the universe, that everyone is at the exact precise center. I said, how can we all be? You're over there and I'm over here. Mm-hmm. How can that be? And it was kind of mystifying to me. And then he said, it's like if you were a raisin in a cake that was rising, everything would be moving away from you and you would be at the center. And the universe is like that, that we are all in the center. And what was interesting to that for me, I had an amazing sense of power in that story. It placed me in a new place in my own story. Well, not better or worse, but I wasn't in the ghetto of the universe. I was in the center of the universe, and everything was available, which is available to all of us. And I think story is such an important thing, and there's something happening in so many different ways with so many different people, from Brian and Jean Houston and Joanna Macy and Barbara Marx. They're all talking about the same thing in a different way. This is another aspect of the story. The confronting stress, confronting sounds like too much of a warrior word, but standing in the face of stress and looking for what the truth is. And I guess what I'm getting at is, here we create these stories and myths, and we live inside them as though they were reality. And yet when we get to this place, it's truth. You know, it's... You know those two gargoyles in the front of the temples in China that they have at the big... Mm-hmm. Do you know what they stand for? Mm-hmm. I think it's really interesting. They're the guardians of the truth. And you actually talk about this in your book. One stands for paradox and the other for confusion.
Uh-huh.
So I guess where I'm trying to go here, James, is to see this relationship to truth, to creative stress, and to evolution unfolding.
Wow, what a wonderful contemplation that is. One of the things that I try to do in the book is to look at great archetypes of, in my own experience, I tell the story of the woman with the bullet next to her heart. You know, here she's walking to work in Northern Ireland and she gets shot and goes to a hospital, and they basically prepare her for death, and then because the bullet is so close to her, they can't operate, and finally they let her go. And stories of that, and then how she lives with that truth that, you know, okay, I have the embodiment of somebody's hatred lodged next to my heart. How do I alchemize that? How do I create in the cauldron of my own being the truth process that transforms that hatred? And she does now reconciliation work between Protestants and Catholics. So to, you know, the story, what I try to do is bring it into, again, people's experience. There's a story of a Vietnam vet who, a very, you know, spiritually developed man that was a friend of mine, met at Fort Bragg. And, you know, after 3 days with this Vietnam vet, he said, what's your spiritual practice? You're the most conscious, alert, you know, in service, always attentive person I've ever met. I want to know your spiritual practice. He said, I was doing mine duty in Vietnam. And every step was a step. Will this be my last step? Every step brought my attention and my consciousness. And he said, I simply have learned to walk like that through my life. So there, that's exactly the cauldron of creative stress and the heart of your question, which is about how do we take this truth, the truth of France's experience in Northern Ireland or this Vietnam vet's experience, how they are evolution in process. They are saying, look at us as paradigms, as frontier evolutionary forces that take the cauldron of experience and wounding, you know, which could lead into the most negative consequences, right? Into hatred or psychotic behavior, and transform it into the energy of awakening, of dialogue, of peaceful living, of conscious awareness. And so I really sincerely believe that evolution is always about her business, looking for that truth, but that, you know, Alfred North Whitehead, who was a great philosopher, said that one of the paradoxes of modernity is that abstractions increasingly are used to control human beings. Abstractions are used to control human beings. And the glory of this process with stress and energy is to say, this is not an abstraction. You can try to push the primary energy of the universe that comes in the most intimate ways into your life, right? We know stress. This energy comes in every way, in the most, you know, very, very personal ways into our lives to transform our consciousness and lift it up. And if we choose not to do that, we can live in the abstraction of, well, I have the right income, I have the right house, I have the right swimming pool, I have the right vacation schedule, I have whatever those things are that start to move us away from the reality of that energy into this make-believe world that will somehow sedate it, control it, keep it quiet, and make it perfect. And then beyond that, and I hope this is not too abstract, but I sincerely think we should go there for a moment. It is the work of the French philosopher Baudrillard, whose work was used for the movie The Matrix. What Baudrillard says is, you know, even more terrifying than what Whitehead was talking about. Whitehead says, abstractions are now used to control us. Baudrillard says, our symbols have now been vacated or empty. There is no reality behind many of the symbols in the modern world. That, you know, you use the symbol of the flag or democracy or whatever you are. You decode them, there's something entirely different.
Normally you decode them, and what I would say at the heart of them, and correct me if I'm going off in another way, but they have become implements to control and enculturate, you know, the essence of it is to control something, the way they've been used in, you know, the flag or the different symbols that we use like that. Am I taking that off in another direction?
No, we're in the heart of it. So thank you so much, because, in the heart of this story is deep stress avoidance. It is, we can make it easy for you because you can be the right people, the right color, the right nation. You can be on top. You know, and here's how you do it. You create a fictional reality. So Baudrillard said it's a simulacrum. It's a pretend reality that we're all doing so well, and we have divine inspiration, and we're the right people, and we've got the right society. Then you deconstruct the reality and say, well, actually, what is at the root of this is a blockage in evolutionary learning of a gross, profound nature. It's like a potential heart attack, you know, because you've delayed your own learning by moving into this pretend reality without doing the homework. That's why I feel with this book, Creative Stress, that the personal and the planetary are so profoundly linked, because when each of us takes on that learning and growth and says, what does it mean to follow this flag? What are the values I put behind this flag? You know, does it include racial dialogue, social healing, community rebirth? Does it give me a good and healthy food supply? Does it give me community? What is this flag really representing? And then I'm told, well, actually, the flag for many people represents no, not them. You know, and yes, the survival of the corporate, you know, the recent Supreme Court decision to me is the great emblem of this devastating loss of meaning, where the Supreme Court says that a multi-billion-dollar corporation is just of the same power and strength in the voice of democracy, you know, as somebody earning $15,000 a year who's struggling to, you know, pay for their health care. That is an anarchic sense of desecration of symbols, isn't it?
I just call it insanity myself.
Yes, well, good.
Yeah. But yes, absolutely. Uh-huh. Absolutely. Yeah.
So I'm glad we're going wide, because this conversation is a wide conversation. One has to not trivialize this, you know, notion around stress, but actually go back to those primary questions of what are the root values that I as a being feel? What are the root qualities that I am here to manifest? And how do I engage in the creation of the manifest world? So it goes right back to our question, big questions around belief. What do you believe this life is all about? If it's an escape route to your God, that's, and it's just a sort of stage of suffering and pernicious pain
on our way to heaven,
really. On our way to heaven,
yeah.
Then naturally you're going to say, well, anything that really stresses me out, I'm going to avoid, because, you know, I want to stay calm and interconnected. And you said earlier we get to the threshold of the word act, and we stay in the philosophical realm so often. It is there in the realm of action that I think much is revealed. And that's why creative stress says, you know, you take all of that energy and you transform it into action. As the Dalai Lama himself says, it is not enough to be compassionate. One must act, because it's in the acting that evolution reveals its next level of competence. It says, behold, you know, I have made this. I've manifested in all of the challenges and obstructions that have, you know, been dealt me, I have manifested justice, truth, beauty, love, forgiveness, gratefulness.
As you're talking, I'm thinking of, I just had a thought about one of my assumptions, which you talk about in the book a little bit. As a young psychology student, I made an observation and an assumption that confusion is a way of not taking responsibility for reality. But I just am thinking here in the way that you combine it into creative stress, that my actions out of that would be a certain kind of action. My actions would be to somewhat discount the dwelling in the meeting with that place of stress or that unwanted part of ourself. Whereas my perhaps weakness is not to dwell in confusion, but to take action or to sever the alternatives with a sense of knowing. Talk a little bit, James, about your sense of the part confusion plays in this evolutionary process of confronting stress in a creative way.
I think belief is so important. So one wants to catalyze one's belief and act upon it and represent it. And we live in an age when there's a lot of coasting going on, you know, in terms of when you say to people, well, what do you really believe? So to actualize your belief is really important. But as you do, you will find that you are constantly in the subtle process of revising your belief. So that if it gets stuck, if it gets frozen, basically what you're saying is you're holding off the stress of growth. You're saying, I'm comfortable now with what I believe, go away. I don't need new facts, I don't need new information, I don't need to be disturbed by Darfur or anything that's going on, because I've got a nice little riff going on in my life. And so the process of confusion is actually wonderful, because it says, I now really understand things about my relationship to nature, to the world, that I didn't understand before. You read about beef, and I frankly don't know how most people can eat beef anymore. Once you really have been told what beef is doing, the raising of beef is doing to the planet, and the inefficiencies, and you know all of the story, when you get that information, you say, okay, I this is confusing, you know. And then you live maybe through that existential voice, but I'm attached to eating this kind of meat, and you know, you wrestle with conscience. And I talk about this in the book too, you know, wrestling with conscience. It sounds old fashioned. Who wrestles with their conscience anymore? Well, that's but you know, the wrestling with conscience is actually coming out of the mental world, or coming out of the fixity of belief, into your own internal dialogue. And if you're not dialoguing within yourself, are you really capable of dialoguing with others? And so you get to this point where, in fact, confusion is part of the process that's necessary to take you to the next point of growth. So, and I think there's a lot in this topic too, because if you think of coherence, right, you say, well, I need to be coherent. You know, the confused person's not coherent, right? You know, and you have to have your stuff together. So when I visualize that, I think of two words, coherence and hypercoherence. And hypercoherence is where all of the dots line up so completely that there's no spaces between them. You know, as president of the Institute of Noetic Sciences at the time, you know, consciousness organization, I had always people emailing me proving every atom, you know, of the meaning of the universe. You can see I've proved everything, kind of person. And I immediately say, okay, that's hypercoherence, because if you've proved everything, what are the spaces in between your truth and my truth? And the truth needs spaces to breathe, so that your truth and my truth can influence each other and we can grow together. Otherwise, it's a dead and it's a static universe. So that confusion that comes in is actually helping you stretch those little spaces in your own truth so that something else can come through. That's again a paradigm of creative stress, isn't it? It says like, okay, push it, you know, grow a little. I know you're so happy being the kind of peacenik you love to be, but now we want you to dialogue with the military and understand where their truth is, so that somehow in this spaces between truth, something new can arise. So that's right. We've been educated to shoot up, you know, from primary school, our hand into the air. Who's got the right answer? You know, rather than who's struggling with this question, and out of that struggle, what the creative cauldron is, something new going to appear, some new synthesis that is really needed.
We're already at the end of our time, and I feel like we've just begun to step on some wonderful territory. I hope we can do this again very soon. But I'm also wanting to kind of wrap this up. And I think as an ending, can you just give us anything that you'd like to say that gives you hope, but also from the handshake to the embrace that you talk about in the book, how can people get on that path, besides getting your book, Creative Stress, which I highly recommend? Just a few words to close about that journey and what gives you hope around that journey.
What gives me hope is that we can get to this point in our consciousness where we understand that the primary stress-avoidant agent is the ego. That the ego is always in some form or another saying, there's an easy way out. You know, I can make it easier for you. Don't, you know, whatever it is.
Bumper sticker.
and that we as a species, each of us, because our consciousness is not dislocated from the whole, as we've talked about, when each of us does this work, we are doing it for the whole. We are resonant within a whole system's resonance, field of resonance. And that it is really this beautiful paradigm where each one of us does the work. And as we do the work, the field becomes richer with that, with those resonances and qualities that we are liberating into existence. That's our task, is to liberate our higher selves, our beautiful frequencies, into this manifest realms, that we are the incarnators of truth and justice and mercy and compassion and wisdom and laughter and so on. And that when, you know, any of us really sees, my gosh, you know, I've locked it up. I've locked it up inside myself. I've locked up some of the qualities of the universe because I was told you're not good enough, or I tell myself you're not good enough, and I play this stress avoidance game. Once I grasp the nettle, face the music. Face the music. Isn't that a beautiful metaphor?
Yes.
Time to face the music of who you are, that you then resonate those frequencies out, and the universe goes, finally, you're being yourself, your delicious, fecund, fertile self. I need you so much in my glorious cause of evolution. It makes it, it turns the struggle into celebration, into the dance of life that says, you know, my, have I grown, and now I, the vistas that I can behold because I've been attentive to my own growth.
Mm. James O.D., thank you so much for your inspiration, for your many years of work, and for your thoughtful conversations that you are bringing to our listeners.
Thank you for such a deep time together.